This is an interview for the Maryland Historical Society McKeldin Jackson Project, September 27, 1976, with Mr. Walter Sondheim at Mr. Sondheim's office in 1 Charles Center. The interviewer is Ellen Paul. I just have some general questions for you first. I'd like to know what began your own personal interest in civil rights.
Goodness gracious, I don't know.
Was it a particular incident?
I was raised in a household where there was some concern for it. But I suppose I was interested in that kind of thing in college a good bit. But my particular interest in Baltimore was influenced some by the fact that I was, how you doing, all right?
It's fine, yeah.
That I was in the midst of part of the controversy because I worked for Hoshel Cohen Company and the downtown department stores had had policies which pushed them into the civil rights area about waiting on customers, waiting on black customers. And that made it a kind of a constant issue. And then I suppose fairly early after I had finished schooling and was in business, I was on the board of the Urban League. But to say what it was is very hard. It was partly a matter of interests in my own home. My father had some interest in this, although as I look back on it, it wasn't as direct as one would think. It was a very direct and concrete interest today, but in terms of those times, it was. And I think that a lot of things at college had an influence on me.
And going back to the incident with the department stores, were you at all involved in the decision to allow black people to try on clothes and be waited on?
Yes, I was.
Would you care to elaborate on that?
Well, part of it was evolutionary, and evolutionary, some of it, in the slowest sense of the word. But the stores at one time, I find it very difficult to place this in time, had a policy of actually discouraging black customers at all, in any sense of the word, in the stores. And then there was practice of not discouraging customers except in departments where you sold things that were tried on, like dresses, hats, and underwear, and things of this sort. And then there got to be this almost incredibly insulting policy of saying blacks could buy things in stores, but weren't allowed to return them, and so the sales check was marked in some way to indicate that it was a final sale or that it couldn't be returned, not returned. And then a little later on, it seems to me, all of these restrictions were dropped different times by different stores. Some of them dropped by specific action, sometimes just by ignoring them. And then the only restriction was a restriction on eating. That was the last one. And that restriction on blacks in the restaurants went on until in the days of the activist civil rights movement and the sit-ins in the South and things and so on. had this policy, and some Morgan students were going to come down, sit in it, and just sit at the tables in the restaurant. And while there were some differences of opinion in the management of the company, and I was part of the management of the company at that time, we decided this was the time to give up the crazy rule. Gave it up. And so that day, black students from Morgan came in and sat down and were waiting on them.
It must have been a great surprise to them.
It was a great surprise and a shock to them. Some of them weren't prepared to eat, pay for the meal. They were they were surprised by it. But anyhow, that ended that. Before that, blacks eating in the private dining rooms. It's hard now to believe that I worked for a company that had such insulting practices or some of these, but they're true. But there had been ferment about this. I remember back in the, do you want me just
no,
talk
please about go it? On.
Back in the 30s, I came to work there in 1929. And this was a matter of concern me and to people that I knew and to friends of mine. And in those days, the fact that the majority of the stores were owned by Jews made this take on a kind of an anti-Semitic flavor. There was at that time a great deal, there was a substantial amount of anti-Semitism among blacks, caused by the fact that Jews were frequently the landlords, both in housing and in stores. Often the proprietors of stores in black neighborhoods on Pennsylvania Avenue, for example, things of this sort. A great many of the contacts that blacks had with white people were contacts with Jews, because rent, where apartments and residences were not owned by Jews, very often the rent collectors were Jewish, and so a great deal of blacks' contact with the people, with the problems that beset them, as the money problems that beset them, associated with people with their own economic situation. The interface with the white community was very substantial through Jews, so that there was a ripeness of ripe field for anti-Semitism. And this got to be a factor in the department store attitudes. Three of the four department stores were Jewish owned, actually, in those times before they had been sold. So that this got to be a factor. I think wisely, and as a matter of technique too, that some of the black organizational leadership used this as a means of trying to bring pressure on the stores to change their policies. And there was a good bit of interest in Jewish organizations and national organizations in New York and places like that, trying to intercede to try to get some movement on the part of the stores. Now, I don't say this is any particular expression of virtue, but it was partly because I was younger. Your ideas are more flexible when you're younger. I was one of those in the stores who tried very hard to affect some change in policy. In those days, I was very new in the business, wasn't in the actual top management of the company, but I knew him well, my father being one of them, and I had plenty to, I guess, tried to have some input, some understanding into it. In those days, Walter White was head of the NAACP nationally. And I got to know Walter White quite well about it. I became kind of an unofficial intermediary between Walter White and some of his communications with the Stores, because he tried to help him set up meetings. Sometimes get some word back to him that people didn't want to write to him directly. The Urban League here was active in it too. Ed Lewis was then head of the Urban League in Baltimore and then went on to national fame when he moved on to New York. And I knew these people. I knew Walter and I knew Ed Lewis. Do you mind turning it off for one minute? In the 30s, Mrs. Jackson, who was a very effective and an energetic president of the local chapter of the NAACP, talked to me on a number of occasions in my office, and I think knew that I had some understanding and some sympathy about the problem. But she felt that just discussing it wasn't getting me any place, so that she was very vigorous in expressing her concerns about it, understandably vigorous. She also, at the time, in doing so, she at that time called particular attention to the fact that these were Jewish-owned stores and pointed out that this was just the time of the rise of Hitler, and she pointed out the inappropriateness in her mind of Jews' practice being involved in this kind of discrimination.
That is an understandable feeling.
I was completely understandable. Unfortunately, the things that are understandable aren't always immediately productive. And I remember for a period of time, to a kind of a hardening of attitudes, because people felt that she was making a Jewish issue out of something that was not a Jewish issue. There were other stores who were practicing the same kind of discrimination, which were not under Jewish management or Jewish ownership. And they felt that this was an unfair tactic. You know, I'm not making a judgment as to whether it was or not, but to state the fact that this really began to harden attitudes.
Well, how did she relate to Jewish leaders later on? You know, and some other issues, for example, Rabbi Goldman, who helped in that community self-survey, or a good number of the Jewish leaders in the community were active in the NAACP and the Gwin Oaks incident.
Oh, let me say this, that this did not in any sense, I think that in fairness to Ms. Jackson, has to be pointed out that this was a specifically related issue to the stores, and the tension that it created was not with the Jewish community as a whole, but with the stores themselves. Now, once in a while, it spilled over into the Jewish community at large. I remember that she wrote a letter to the Afro once, which got some people very upset, because it was kind of people felt that it was going to cause a spread of anti-Semitism in the black community. And the fact is that a great many, it ought to be clear that a great many Jewish leaders, both nationally and locally, said that it was pointed out to the stores that some movement on their part would lessen this business, not to put the blame on Mrs. Jackson for any possible spread or incitement to anti-Semitism, but the fact that the stores themselves could make a contribution in lessening of the tension if they would do something about their practices. So there was a very complex fair, and I think that if you were to ask me about in later years, and I think it's important to say that there was no indication of ever of any of an anti-Semitic feeling on Mrs. Jackson's part. She used this and pointed it out, and because of the sensitivity of Jews, particularly at the time, because of what was happening in Germany, I think that people interpreted this as an anti-Semitic act. But to say that she was is obviously wrong, because she was never shown any indication of that in later life.
Maybe we can jump a little bit here.
Sure.
and go back and start with some questions about McKeldin. I would like to know how you met him and what kind of relationship you had with him, business relationship or personal.
How did I first meet McKeldin? The slightest idea. It seems that now that you ask me, it gives me the feeling that I always knew. I must have known him because I was involved in some civic activities. I'm trying to think. What were his terms as mayor? What were his years?
He was mayor from 43 to 47 and 63 to 67.
Well, I knew him less well, perhaps, in the 43 to 47 period. Although I guess I was involved in some things, I guess I got to see him because at that time, before I went in the Navy, I was involved in the United States Employment Service here. I'd been loaned by Hoshel Coons to be head of the Employment Service for Maryland during the war, which was federalized during the war, and to work in the War Manpower Program. That was just for the short time until I went in the Navy. This threw me in touch with public officials quite extensively. And I suppose I didn't really know him so very well in that period. In the second, then he became governor.
Governor for eight years, right?
And I saw him during that period. I suppose used to see him on a lot of ceremonial occasions, and he and I had always hit it off very well and had been good friends. I have to say that he had an enormous number of friends. He was a gregarious, extroverted kind of person, and he had a lot of friends, and I was pleased to be one of them. Then during his second term of mayor, which years did you say?
63 to 67.
Yeah, well, those were urban renewal commission days for me, and I was really really a part of his administration in that sense.
The Urban Renewal and Housing Agency was part of the administration?
Oh, yes, indeed it was. And although I got out of the chairmanship of the Urban Renewal and Housing Commission just after he came into office, I maintained a very close friendship with him. The fact is, there must have been some way, and that I just can't remember, of what caused my relationship with him before he became mayor, when he was still governor. But I know that I knew him well. And during his second stint as mayor in the 60s, I saw a great deal of him, and I knew him very well. I remember that. Well, I remember that he was governor at the time the schools were desegregated.
You're answering all my questions before I get to them. That's quite all right. Go ahead.
And I'd have to, I don't want to make history, but my recollection is that the schools were desegregated in, the Brown versus Board of Education was in 1954. And the schools were desegregated at once, and then had trouble in the fall of 74, where we had what we thought then was rioting by today's terms. It was very mild, but it sure seemed like rioting to me.
Of 1974?
No, 1954.
54, okay.
After the schools opened very quietly, and then trouble began with parents being upset by the integration of schools. We had large troubles starting on Washington Boulevard, and then spread to the junior high schools. We had a 4 or 5 days of what were the most exciting and the most unpleasant days of my life. Between getting excited about the outpouring of support in the Baltimore community, which was really a heartwarming thing on the one side, and physical fear on the other side because of what was going on, and a lot of concerns. It was a rough period. My recollection is that Ted McKeldin was running for governor at the time. He was governor and was
running for a second term.
Would that be right in the fall of
54?
Well, it's very hard to recreate that atmosphere, but in those days, desegregation was a brand new idea. The Baltimore City schools were the only ones in the state that had been desegregated. As a matter of fact, there were some people in the State Department of Education who felt that the Baltimore City School Board didn't have a right to go ahead and do what it did without consulting with them. But we didn't consult with them, and we did it.
But now that's how you were president of the school board.
Right? I was president of the school board then, that's right. The attitudes in other parts of the state were very different. In Southern Maryland, the Eastern Shore, people were much more concerned about the problem of integration there. The whole history of what had happened in their school systems was different. Baltimore felt it was better prepared for it, and was able to go ahead. And I don't, because I'm not passing judgment on whether Eastern Shore, Southern Maryland were right or wrong, but there were strong feelings about it. And the governor was trying to get elected, and we were going around trying to get evidence of public support for what we had done. I remember the governor was campaigning on the Eastern Shore, and somebody on his staff pointed out that this was not an appropriate time for us to get a statement from him about how the trouble in the Baltimore school should end. But he was always supportive of us. But he didn't, I remember at that time, he took the position that he was a state official. Is it all over?
No, it doesn't make a noise when it stops, and I have to keep checking it.
That he was a state official and that he wasn't going to interfere with what Baltimore City did, but he was supportive of what we did, of the program. And I think that kind of experience helped me to be a close friend of Ted McKeldin's.
Would you describe his personality for me?
It's so hard to do.
Well, we've heard all sorts of different stories. He was occasionally known to let a curse word slip, and he never did, and he occasionally got quite angry, and other people said, oh, he never was angry. And other people said that, some people have doubted his sincerity, for example, in the civil rights issue. Would you comment on that?
Yeah, I'll start by commenting on that it's impossible to doubt his sincerity on that issue. I think that it came out of what was a religious type conviction on his part that developed into a real concern for human beings. And he took strong positions on the civil rights issue when there was no possible political gain to him for doing it. And I think that it is wrong to doubt his sincerity. This thing that I told you before about the fact that he didn't come out with a strong statement while he was campaigning on the Eastern Shore was is not an indication that he wasn't sincere. But I heard him outspoken with people on a number of occasions where it would have been a much more popular act for him to be and not to be. I don't think anybody can doubt his sincerity on this issue. I think that Ted McKeldin was such a, there was a little bit of the ham actor in him. In fact, there was a lot of it. And his very manner of speech, his intonation, his kind of professional oratory gave people the feeling that he was often an actor. And indeed he was a lot of the time. He was an actor, and he didn't really hide it. So that I think people thought that this was an indication of insincerity on his part. I think it's true that he often made speeches and embraced issues and people where it may have seemed more attractive to him on a kind of a flamboyant basis, or because he thought it would appeal to people. So that I don't mean that everything that he did was etched with sincerity. But on the civil rights issue, that's the one thing that stood out, it seems to me, in bold relief sometimes, that this was something which his sincerity could not have been doubted. And I think that there are some other things where he was much more the typical politician of fitting his words to the situation. Joke with him sometimes, and he didn't always appreciate it about the fact that he could be a Catholic in a Catholic gathering and a Jew in a Jewish gathering, and be really kind of all things to all people. He always had a story that fitted in with them. Sometimes stories, I remember a few things, but not exactly. What had happened, but they seemed appropriate to him, and they weren't stories that hurt anybody. I can't remember what it was about, but I recall once saying to him, after I'd heard him make a speech at lunch and tell a story of something that had happened, and it happened to be a story that I had been involved in, and after it was over, I saw him and said to him, "Ted, that's some story you told, because, you know, it really didn't happen." "Oh, well," he said, "it didn't happen, it could have happened that way," and he said, "it's not anything that did anybody any harm." And it didn't, and it wasn't exactly, you can't say it was a piece of insincerity, it was part of a kind of a way of his selling ideas to people that he thought were sound. And the fact that he twisted history a little bit in something didn't mean that he was doing something that was intellectually dishonest or anything else. He was really a remarkable person. I did hear him swear once or twice, and the reason I can say that is that it was such a dramatic thing when he did, because he was not a person who used profanity as part of his everyday speech the way some of us do. And he didn't. I'm sure he had a side that I didn't know, too. He had different kinds of compartmentalized friends. He had political friends, and I didn't know him in that setting at all. I knew him. He used to call me up sometimes. He was, of all the mayors in Baltimore, he's the one that was most complimentary to me, because there's nothing better than having your advice asked. But he'd call me up sometime in the middle of the afternoon and said, "Come down here, I want to see you." And I'd go down there and sit for an hour while he'd talk about things, and people waiting on the outside of his room to see him and running late on his calendar used to embarrass me. I hate to walk past them. But he often did that, and once in a while he came up to my house on Saturday morning and sat down and talked to me about problems. I remember one very serious problem he had once that I would not want to talk about, particularly because it was a very personal problem of his. He came up on Saturday morning and really upset. And he didn't like to be kidded about his ability to play a role in the situation. I remember asking him, in pure joking once, said to him just before we went in to eat, I guess we were both at a table or something, I forgot the circumstances. I said to him, this must be a tough evening for you. I said, how do you decide whether you're going to be a Catholic, a Protestant, or a Jew? And he didn't like it. It taught me a lesson about it, and I thought I knew him pretty well. He didn't like that joke. He thought identifying with the people he was with was a very important part of his life. He didn't look on this as an act the way a lot of people did, and indeed I did sometimes.
Perhaps as someone who was a close personal friend, you can tell me if he ever mentioned any aspirations to the federal level or higher level government.
No. I remember one of the things he was proudest of was the fact that he made either the nominating or the second day speech for Eisenhower. Excuse me. And this was something he took great pride in. And I don't remember his ever saying that. I've got a faint recollection of the fact that he used to talk about the fact that people had mentioned him for the vice presidency, I think. I don't remember this as being anything very significant.